Welcome to the Natural Running Network. My name is Richard Diaz, and I'll be your host. What I hope to do is introduce you to some amazing athletes, luminaries from the sports science community, and as come to be expected, I'll also provide some highly opinionated rants on all aspects of endurance sport and my current favorite, obstacle course racing. So sit tight, grab a cup of coffee, and let's do this. I am pleased to say that at long last, I have my dear friend, Matt Fitzgerald, on the show with us once again. He's releasing a new book, this book entitled The Endurance Diet, Discover the Five Core Habits of the World's Greatest Athletes to Look, Feel, and Perform Better. Matt Fitzgerald is a book machine when it comes to endurance sport. I respect and love the work he does, and I'm very pleased to have him back on the show. Matt, say hello to my people.
Hello, people.
So, Matt, I know last time we spoke, and it's been a while, hasn't it? This must have been about half a year.
Yeah, it's been a gap, and it was tough to get through, but here I am.
Yeah, well, point being is that I know that last time we spoke, you were in the midst of developing this book, and you had just come back from some travel. I believe you had gone over to Kenya for a bit and done some work there, and man, what a life you're living.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of my job, which isn't really a job. I just make up things I want to do and find excuses to write about them, and I guess that is my job. So yeah, it makes for a pretty good life.
Yeah. Well, what I love about this book is that I guess the term, and it's used a lot, I'm going to use it again. It's evidence-based, right?
Correct.
So what you've done is you've gone out and you've done the research, you did the due diligence, looked into the lives and performances of some of the greatest athletes on the planet, and drew the commonality in the way they feed to play, to share with our athletic audience, to get them to understand what they should or should not be doing where their nutrition is concerned.
Yep.
Is that pretty well encapsulated?
That's it in a nutshell.
Well, and so what I love about this is that I have clients I coach. I have people that I work with that are serious, I guess, for lack of a better term. They're very serious about their approach to the sports they're involved in. And they want to earn a living. They are willing to do just about anything to improve their performances, taking on more work, taking on less work, looking at what the competition's doing, trying to emulate what the winners are doing, never really certain what the hell they should be doing on their own accord. And I think, and you may support this, I don't know, but I think that where they drop the ball most often is in the way they feed themselves.
Yeah. That's why I wrote this book.
Yeah, I had a feeling. And there are so many things out there. There's so many fad diets. And, you know, I'm an old man. I've been doing this for a long time. And I've seen a lot of crap come and go. And what's interesting about it, when it comes, it usually goes. Never really hangs on because it never seems to survive the test of time. Somebody tries this new fad diet for a little bit, has success. Everybody emulates that particular athlete, so they try to do what he does. And it's a function of the study of one. Works for me, it'll work for you. They go out and try it, they fail. Or they'll blame something else for why they failed. And it's just ugly, right?
It is.
So give our folks kind of a broad scope of how you put this all together.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been driving me crazy for a while that, you know, as part of my work, I hang out with elite endurance athletes and I watch what they do. I interact with them. And, And at the same time, I also devote a fair amount of time to helping recreational endurance athletes, you know, achieve their goals. Everyone from, you know, rank beginners to sub elites. And, you know, I've just noticed for a long time that the recreational athletes aren't doing what the elite athletes are doing in training or diet. And I think that's kind of crazy. I mean, obviously, you know, Joe and Jane marathon runner can't do everything, you know, an elite Kenyan marathoner does, but still, I mean, they should be looking to, they should at least know what the best practices of the best athletes are. So it's been a, it's been a big part of my mission for a while. That's why I wrote the 80/20 running book. And then this is sort of the diet version of that, where, you know, so many of these fad diets are supported by reductionist science. And, you know, it's gotten to the point where you can make a scientific seeming argument in defense of any old crazy diet. And so what I wanted to do with this book was just kind of shift the whole terms of the debate and essentially say, this is overstating it a bit, but science schmiance. Let's just look at real world evidence. Like let's look at what's actually working for the most successful athletes. And of course, if they were all doing different things, then there wouldn't be much guidance to be gleaned from that exercise. But in fact, there are common patterns that we see in the diets of elite endurance athletes in all disciplines, not just running, and but, you know, triathlon, rowing, cross-country skiing, you name it, and all over the world. And I think that these things exist as universals for a reason, because they work better than the alternatives. So that's really the premise of the book. And I wanted to, I'm not a scientist, but I wanted to sort of do this as scientifically as I was capable of doing. So, I really did my research. I traveled all over the world, to interact with elite endurance athletes, but I also created kind of like a standardized survey and sent that out to, because I couldn't travel everywhere. But I wanted to reach as many different types of athletes in as many countries as possible. And so gathered a lot of data and kind of synthesized it in this book.
Okay. So I'm going to cut to the chase and let's just kind of visit the what to do versus what not to do. And you know, and I know that carbohydrates gotten a bad rap over the years. People shy away from breads when they go to dinner. They take the bun off their hamburger, and they just got caught up in the idea that by eating carbohydrate, that's going to make them fat. And in simple strokes, you know, we know this not to be true. What makes people fat is too much food and not enough activity. It's got nothing to do with carbohydrate, because carbohydrate is a necessity. It's fuel. And in the absence of fuel, there's absence of performance. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, this is a Pandora's box, and there's a lot to be said on the topic. But yeah, I totally agree. I mean, usually when people go on a low carb diet and they lose weight, they'll say, "See, carbs do make you fat." But what they're really doing is throwing out the baby with the bathwater. What the reason they lost weight is because they cut out low quality carbohydrate food sources, not because they cut out carbs in general. You can modify your diet in a way that does not reduce your carb intake, but does reduce your intake of sugars and refined grains, and you will also lose weight. And by separating, high quality carbs from low quality carbs, you can see that it's not really carbs in general that are to blame.
Well, not only that, but the fact of the matter is that carbohydrate contains a lot of water. And as you start to restrict carbohydrate, you're going to drop water weight. But it's not that you're improving the value of your body composition, because you're not improving your lean weight, and you're not really subtracting the fat weight. You're just subtracting water from your weight.
Yep.
That tends to come back pretty quickly.
Yep.
And pretty easily. So I was fascinated by some of the revelations in respect to some of these world-class athletes and the way they fed themselves. And the commonality, aside from the fact that they seem to be eating high-quality food and not detracting from pretty much anything, the volume of food that they consume and the percentage of carbohydrate is pretty high.
Yeah. So yeah, there's sort of, you know, there are five, you know, core habits that that I identified in these athletes, and you've just kind of isolated two of them, which is I call it a carbohydrate centered diet, and also these folks eat enough, and you know, some of my survey questions sort of got to that. You know, there's quality and then there's quantity of food intake. And by and large, these athletes are much more fearful of not eating enough than they are of eating too much, which actually makes sense. Obviously, what you really want to do is eat exactly the right amount. But people, especially, you know, recreational athletes who are afraid of eating too much and put, you know, calorie restrictions on themselves, those people actually don't often end up eating exactly the right amount. They tend to eat too little and then drive themselves nuts with eating too little, and then kind of snap and binge. And so they end up sort of pinballing back and forth between eating not enough and eating too much. Whereas elite athletes, yes, they're burning a ton of calories, so they need to take in a ton of calories. But in terms of how they actually go about eating the right amount, it's not through artificial calorie limits or any form of calorie counting. They'll do that sometimes during, you know, short periods for a specific purpose. But by and large, they just do it through mindfulness. They just pay attention to their body's needs, and they don't eat because it looks good. They eat because they're physically hungry and they need the calories. And that seems to be a much more reliable way to thread that needle and eat neither too much nor not enough.
Let me share with you that lately, one of the things that I've been focusing on, I don't know if you're aware of it, but I've been traveling around the country doing clinics. And in the course of these clinics that I do, I've been doing VO2 testing, and I've also been doing resting metabolic assessments. And I've been doing the resting metabolic assessments. I added that to the offering because I felt that it's important that the athletes that I work with get a better handle on the fact they're probably not feeding properly.
Yep.
And what I find, and is usually really surprising to most of the people that I test, is how few calories they're getting relative to what is needed.
Yep.
And I mean, aside from everything else, I mean, whether we're going to break it down, what the macronutrients are going to be, and when they're going to consume it, I'll look at a guy and his resting metabolism is about 3,500 calories. And then we do a VO2 on them, and we look at an average aerobic workout for an hour. The cost is around 1,000 calories. So not taking into account a lot of other things, just off the cuff, resting metabolism plus 1 hour exercise, the demand is around 4,000 calories. And they look at me like I'm absolutely crazy. And then we look at what they are eating. And a lot of people don't even know. I'm not suggesting that people should get into this calorie counting mentality daily, but at least getting to a place where you understand what you're lacking or what is needed, and then go from there. Because I see that a lot of these guys, you know, after the test, we'll have this conversation. When was the last meal you consumed? And what is your workouts look like? So typically, I'll hear somebody say, my last meal of the evening would be like 7 o'clock. I get up at 6. I do my workout. And then I'll come home, and then I might have something to eat. And so they've effectively fasted for better than 12 hours and then accelerated the fast by doing the work without any food. And they come back with comments like, oh, you know, I really can't exercise when I've eaten. I feel sluggish if I eat. And so I guess I wanted to share with you and ask you, when you talk about eating for
satiety.
Satiety. You know, I've not been in this country very long, so. My question is if you're just eating to ensure that you're getting adequate food, you're going to satisfy your hunger, don't you find that we kind of train ourselves in that regard when I start pushing people into eating more food, they just feel like, oh my God, I cannot take all this food. How can I pop? And then after they kind of adopted and they've taken it on for a few weeks, if they miss a meal off of their plan, they're like dying. You know, I mean, you train your right. hunger, don't you?
Yeah. Yep. And it goes in both directions. You know, obviously if you're talking about the population at large versus just endurance athletes, what we're trained to do is overeat for the most part. And that's what has given rise to this idea that you cannot trust your appetite to properly regulate the amount of food you consume. But that's just a ridiculous notion. I mean, millions of years of evolution went into honing that mechanism. Like, you know, do animals in the wild have no idea how much they should eat, you know, based on hunger? They're not counting calories. How about human infants? You know, you can trust your appetite. It's just, you know, in the environment we live in, we've been just trained to, you know, eat whenever. So we've lost that sensitivity, but there's pretty good research and I adduced it in my book to show that you can get back in touch with that. But it is, as you suggest, a matter of retraining. It's a process, but anyone can do it.
So the other elephant in the room, I really want to shed some light on this because it's been difficult for me. I get a lot of these guys that are chasing down this new fad of this fat-adapted diets, endurance athletes that are believing that or have been basically told that they can function better, improve better, go longer, not requiring carbohydrate if they train themselves to get into this fat-adapted diet. Can you shed some light on some of the research you did in that regard?
Yeah. So, you know, there's really no evidence, you know, to support that philosophy. I mean, there is evidence that if you do endurance training and maintain a high fat diet, you can vastly increase your muscles' capacity to burn fat. But people who are on this high fat diet bandwagon treat that as if that's the goal. Like, last I checked, no one was handed a trophy after a race for burning the most fat between the start and finish line. You know what I mean? Like, the goal is to perform better, and there's just no evidence that you perform better on one of these diets. And in fact, there's, you know, the preponderance of evidence is that, you know, anything up to about, you know, 90 minutes, 2 hours, you're going to perform worse because, you know, burning carbs is important too. You know, what you really want to be able to do is just burn more energy than anyone else in the race, regardless of where it comes from. So I call it means attachment, where people get attached to achieving a certain end by a particular means, and nobody should care what works and what doesn't. The goal, like I said, is performance. So who cares? Like, you know, just labeling things good and bad, carbs good or carbs bad, fat good. It just gets you, you become, you know, penny wise and pound poor through that. You just lose perspective as, you know, with regard to what you're actually trying to achieve. So yeah, I mean, if the goal is performance and you do races, if you do any races that last less than 2 hours, you absolutely want to have a carbohydrate centered diet, selective carbohydrate restriction around, you know, particular workouts can be advantageous. When you get to the ultra distance stuff, and obviously the high fat thing is really caught on among ultra runners, there at least it can be a wash, sort of a neutral. You're doing no better or no worse. But there are certain other negatives, not the least of which is that a 70% fat diet is just it. I mean, try eating that way if you haven't done it. there's like, you have to reduce your diet to about six things, you know, six things that you eat over and over and over. You have to eliminate, you know, fruit and, you know, even things like whole grains, even things like dairy they don't have the right ratio. It's just, you just end up eating like a weirdo. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just go out to a restaurant with friends and just chill and enjoy some haute cuisine. So just like, you know, there's a long list of problems, but, you know, just even if you forget the other ones and focus on performance, it's just, it's not the way to go.
Well, the argument that I pose when I get into these conversations is, if you look, again, it's evidence-based, if you look at the athletes that historically are challenged for great distances at high intensity, I guess the best model for that is looking at the Tour de France. And I know, I have personal friends that are exercise scientists that work with these athletes during the tour and feed them, and they don't eat high-fat diets. Mind you, they eat fat, but they don't rely on a high-fat diet. There's very, very few people, if any, that actually are successful in that sport that adopted a diet like that. They're commonly very, very high in their carbohydrate, and they just eat a buttload of food, right?
Yep.
So,
yeah.
And then the other end of it is, given that I do testing, and I see it every day, as the intensity goes up, the percentage of carbohydrate improves and the utilization of fat drops off. And if you plan on, like you suggested, if you plan on winning an event, you're going to have to eat some carbs. You're going to have to bust some carbs up in your diet. Otherwise, you're just going to run out of the fuel that's necessary to provide you the intensity needed to win these races, right?
Yeah. And not even just to win them, because, you know, intensity is relative. So, you know, if you are a runner and you occasionally run half marathon, even if you're mainly an ultra runner, like if you want to compete at these distances that have higher intensities, you know, the same principles that apply to the people trying to win these races apply to you as well. If you are on a low carb diet, you're going to lose a little bit of your VO2 max. You may well lose a bit of your capacity to absorb higher training loads, and you're just going to take a step or two back. Whether your goal is just to PR somewhere in the middle of the field or to win.
And it seems that just from where I sit and my experiences, that those that lend themselves towards a vegan diet run into the same kind of problems. They just don't seem to have the snap. They don't seem to recover as well as athletes that have a fuller plate. Have you any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this gets back to habit number one, which is eat everything. And you know what I found with elite endurance athletes is that they don't eliminate food groups or food types or demon nutrients as so many people on fad diets do. These elite endurance athletes have just an inclusive, balanced, varied diet where nothing is off limits, including, some low quality treats. I think, just having the occasional brownie or whatever, just it makes an overall high quality diet more sustainable. And this makes sense, right? Because, human beings are nature's ultimate omnivores. There are all these revisionist histories of human diet, that are created to support various fad diets. But the fact of the matter is we are designed to eat everything. and so it's not surprising that the diet and we're also natural endurance athletes as a species. So it's just not at all surprising that the diet that seems to work best to support endurance performance is one that includes every food group, even the ones that are, commonly vilified by popular diets. This is not to say that you can't, perform at a high level, as a paleo person or a vegan, but you're just making it hard for yourself. There's nothing to be gained, and there's a lot of risk taken on. So yeah, I know very successful vegan endurance athletes, endurance athletes who don't eat grains or whatever, but I know a lot more who crash and burn when they go on one of these diets.
That was exactly what I was going to say, and I concur. I mean, I know guys that, despite what I would feel would be reasonable, get by with diets that they're left wanting. And I just don't, it's just harder, to ensure that you're getting good, complete protein. You're getting all the essential aminos in the food groups that you're drawing from. It's a sticky wicket. You got to be pretty sharp and you got to really be on top of it. And I think it's a lot harder to pull it off than it is if you were just to get out there and enjoy the fruits of what's available. So let's kind of walk through what you exhibit here is the five core habits of world greatest athletes. We already kind of touched on it a little bit, but just for the audience, can you walk through it, at least graze through it for us?
Yeah, sure. So habit number one is eat everything, which we just talked about. And that means, you know, just have a maintain a diet that includes all of the major food types, including, you know, low quality treats, you know, as something that makes up, you know, has a marginal but consistent place in your diet. Number two is eat quality. And, you know, so of the, you know, the full catalog of different food types, some are high quality, others are low quality. The high quality food types are fruits, vegetables, whole grains, dairy, unprocessed meat and fish, and kind of a category I call nuts, seeds, and healthy oils. So your diet should be made up mostly of those. And again, when I look at endurance athletes, elite endurance athletes around the world, that's what they're eating most of. The four low quality food types in my classification system are refined grains, sweets, processed meats, and fried foods. And those can be in the diet, but they should have, again, sort of a marginal place in it. So that's what it means to maintain a high quality diet. Everything is included, but it's, you know, it's really weighted towards the high quality food types. Then habit number three is eat carbohydrate centered. And that really just means that, you know, what I observed is that unless, you know, an athlete's doing some kind of carbohydrate restricted individual workout, they are including high quality, high carbohydrate foods in every meal and in most snacks. So that's what it means to maintain a carbohydrate centered diet. Habit number four is eat enough. And that's the idea that the quantity of food that you consume is determined by your real energy needs, which are communicated to you through your own body, you know, through, you know, built-in, you know, appetite regulatory mechanisms. And, you know, what I observed among elite endurance athletes just in general is that they are super tuned into their body's needs, you know, with diet and with training. And that applies to the specific issue of appetite and regulating how much food they eat. So, you know, they neither overeat nor do they undereat, you know, based on, you know, just listening to their bodies and supplying them with what their bodies ask for. And then habit number five. So those are sort of, you know, the first four are sort of universals. Habit number five is eat individually. And this makes sense, right? Because, you know, we're all human, but we're also all, you know, unique. And what I definitely observed in my research is that, you know, it's again part of being tuned into individual needs being tuned into one's body is that your body is not the same as that of the athlete next to you. So, you know, for example, when I went to Spain and spent a few days with a professional cycling team, it's actually a Dutch team, but they were in Spain for a training camp. And I would sit at the table with the whole team and I would look at their plates and no two plates were the same. And I would sort of quiz each individual athlete as, you know, why are you eating this? Why aren't you eating that? And there was always a reason. It was based on, you know, this doesn't agree with me or I'm allergic to that. Or I just noticed that, you know, if I eat that, I gain weight or I don't perform as well. So that's a part of it as well. There's some responsibility on you as an individual athlete to pay attention to connect cause and effect and to, you know, over time, just move toward an optimum in your diet that may be a little bit different from that of what anyone else is doing.
Did we get the list? Is that all?
That's five.
Okay, cool. So now I got to ask you a question that I don't know whether you're going to want to answer it or not, but it's on my mind, so I got to ask you. I know you have, over the years, followed a lot of the works of Tim Noakes. And you know that he's come out pretty hard on carbohydrates over the last few years. Have you had conversation with him about any of those theories and philosophies that he's espousing?
No, I can tell you that I'm blocked from his Twitter feed.
You know, it hurt me. Honestly, I got to tell you, and you know, again, what's cool about getting old is you have license to say almost anything you want to, and people give you a pass, which is kind of where I'm going these days. But I have always loved his work. I mean, The Lore of Running in my mind was just a great piece, and I think I started with the second edition and read on up through the final edition that he put out. And we have conversed, him and I, on training philosophies in the past. And I was just, I had a lot of respect. I still have a lot of respect for him. And I was like a little taken back by his position on this whole, you know, hate the carbs thing. And I want to believe that in part, it's due to the fact that he personally is diabetic and has some issues with carbohydrates himself. And again, you don't need to touch on this if you don't want to, but I was just curious what your thought was.
Yeah, so I'm in the same boat. You know, Tim, he wrote the foreword to my Brain Training for Runners book. And that was, I mean, he really did me a solid with that. And you know, so we interacted for a long time. He was kind of a quasi mentor. I would go to him with things, and he was generous with his time, and you know, I really respected his intellect. But yeah, that low carb thing just came out of nowhere. And you know, it wasn't just the substance, but the style of it that was and is disappointing to me. That we're and I know this is true. I've talked to other people, you know, people who studied under him at the University of Cape Town, who are just scratching their heads, wondering, you know, what happened. This isn't. I mean, he was always a maverick, and he was always a bit of a loose cannon. But you know, just what he's doing with the low carb diet thing is just kind of fundamentally non-rational. And you know, it's just one of those things. I wish him no ill, but I mean, I view myself as in competition with him in terms of actually supplying athletes with advice that's going to help them, not hurt them. So, right. You know, I'm in that sense, I'm kind of at loggerheads with him now.
Well, that was kind of my feeling, to be very honest with you. I'm looking at this and I know the influence he has. And for him to take the position he has, I think it's been a disservice. I just think that he's leading people down an ugly road. Yeah, you know, for whatever it's worth. And I mean, it's probably something we could talk about over a beer, but I don't know. I just wanted to get your bite on it because it did. It chilled me to the bone when I saw how, I mean, I've listened to some podcasts he's done and, you know, he's laying it down and a lot of people are influenced by what he has to say. And he's had great influence over me over the years. So I, like you, I felt like I relied a lot on his words. And now I'm like, God, dude, he's not invited to any more parties.
And if he is, and if he does come over to a party, you better be careful what you serve.
Yeah. Nothing but meat. We're just gonna All right. So let's talk about a couple of the other books that you did, because for those that, I mean, I'm sure that everybody on the planet that's endurance sport knows who you are at this point in time. But you've got some other great stuff. And we had a conversation just the other day. Who was I talking to? Somebody asked me about, we were talking about the controversy of Iron War. And yeah, I was having lunch with a fella and he brought it up and I said, you know what? I think that's probably one of Matt's best books. One of my favorites anyway. And I don't know, I mean, obviously because I have history with the sport. But anyway, for whatever it's worth, I think that those listening, if you get a chance, you might want to pull up Iron War. That's right? It's Iron War, right?
Yep.
Which was the story about Mark Allen and Dave Scott and their duel at Ironman, which was an amazing, amazing competition. And the backstory is pretty fascinating, and I thought Matt did an amazing job with that. So you heard it from me first, Matt.
For those listening who aren't familiar with the controversy, Dave and Mark sued me when the book came out. It was eventually settled. But yeah, that was super stressful, you know, because those guys, I mean, it's a weird experience. Like, those guys were my heroes growing up. And yeah, that's part of why I wrote the book, is that I thought that their story was amazing. It's kind of the endurance version of, you know, Martina Navratilova and Chris Everett Lloyd, but even better, you know, even richer. And so I wanted, you know, I was motivated to write the book because I wanted other people to sort of appreciate that story the way I did, and to have it kind of blow up in my face the way it did was, it was tough. It was really stressful. But you know, people who have read the book, you know, generally they do like it quite a lot. So that's been gratifying. And I hope a lot of that gets back to Dave and Mark, where they, I don't know, I think they sort of feared that somehow what I wrote was going to sully their reputations, but I think it has really done the opposite. And I'm hopeful that they're seeing that, you know, with the passage of time.
Well, that was pretty much the case. I read that open letter that they put out. Yeah, they were a little hurt, to put it lightly. But the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, and a couple things I want to ask you about, and I don't mean to get too far off point here, but first of all, before we do, I want to make sure everybody understands the endurance. Is it out yet, the endurance diet?
It is not officially out. You can pre-order it, and please do, but the official publication date is December the 27th.
Okay. You will make sure I get a copy of that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Consider it done.
I wanted to ask you a couple questions, two things that came up. First of all, you have another book called The 80-20. It's a training philosophy. And I know that you just ran a marathon, and you, before we got on, you told me you weren't pleased with the finish time. But I also saw a thread on Facebook that suggested you signed up for 7 more marathons.
Yeah.
You know what? The last time you and I were like in front of each other over a glass of wine, you were complaining that your body just didn't take it anymore. And this has been some years ago. You've been juicing? What's going on?
Yeah, excuse me. I've always been injury prone. And, you know, but giving up wasn't an option for me. You know, I was just always, you know, I always wanted to race and to race to the best of my ability. So over the years, I just learned ways to adapt to, you know, to get injured less often without sacrificing my competitive ambitions. So I just, you know, over time adopted a formula that's a little weird.
You said it's kind of a goofy formula. What is that goofy formula? What precisely are you doing that's working for you?
Yeah, so I just do a ton of cross training. And, you know, I have history as a triathlete as well, but for the last 7 years, I've been focused on running, but I only run 3 to 4 times per week. And of course you can't really, you know, you can't win races on 3 to 4 runs per week. So I supplement that with a ton of low and non-impact cardio cross training. And I mix it up. I have these patented steep uphill treadmill walks that I do. I have an Elliptigo outdoor elliptical bike. I have a regular bike that I ride. So I just do a ton of that stuff. I wouldn't be doing this if I still could run twice a day, but I just can't. And I also, you know, do a fair amount of strength training. So it's a high volume, low running volume approach to training. And I'm also very, very judicious with high intensity training. You know, it's got to be in the mix if you want to toe starting lines, you know, fit and ready to rip. But I have to be very, very careful, you know, just kind of sprinkle it in as a seasoning, the high intensity stuff. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's interesting. I knew you were using the Elliptigo, and I know that you were supplementing your running with that at one point in time. I told you I got on the thing, and we never could get along, me and that thing. I tried it. Yeah. Didn't work.
Yeah.
The movement was weird for me. I couldn't wrap my head around it. So getting on the bike old school is kind of what I've done.
Yep.
So you've been doing a lot of, I'm assuming, real steep uphill walking, like a Nordic track or something like that?
Yeah, I've got my own treadmill, and I crank it up all the way, 15%. I've got a combination of incline and speed that puts my heart rate about where it would be during an easy run. It's a little dull, but I'm a voracious reader, so I just, set it up, fire up my Kindle, and do the work. And there's no question, just based on, I'm 45, so I'm slowing down due to age, but just based on how I'm performing in races, with this way of training, I really can't imagine I don't think I'm giving anything up. Honestly, I don't think I would be doing any better if I still was able to, run twice a day.
How much actual volume running are you getting in a week?
It can get pretty high because I make every run count. And that's another part of, my formulas that I now do, things like, back to back 20 mile runs. I do over distance runs. So I'll do a 50K training run in training for a marathon. So sometimes, with the four runs I do in a week, it can add up to 60 miles. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, well, you're not doing anything crazy then. I mean, that's still a lot of volume. I mean, it's not crazy volume, but it's definitely, it's suitable volume. I could see where easily 60 miles a week is adequate to turn out the type of times you're hoping for.
Yeah. But that would be a high. I mean, sometimes it's closer to, 40, 45 miles of running, but there's clearly a crossover benefit that I'm taking some of the fitness I gain from the other activities and injecting it into the running. For sure.
Oh, well, that's interesting. With the OCR community that I've been working with these days, what's gotten to be very popular is these Nordic track treadmills that have like 40, 60% grade.
Yep.
And I'm not sure that I dig that. I think that's a little steep.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of detracts from where you're putting the load.
Yep.
Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. At a certain point, the joint angles are so far away from what they are when you're actually running that you're just, cross training. The idea is to have it be as similar to running as possible, except that it's just not running without the impact part. That's why, the ultimate cross training for running is anti-gravity treadmill running, because that actually is still running.
Right.
You can just do it pain-free with most injuries, or just do it with less stress on the body. You want things. That's why there's kind of a spectrum. Like swimming and rowing aren't going to do much for you at all. Yeah, you're going to get your heart rate up, but those are upper body dominant activities. So along that spectrum, I would think that a moderate gradient on a treadmill is just going to be neuromuscularly more like running than if you're, cranking it up to 40%, and that's almost like climbing, where you're scrabbling up a cliff face.
Yeah, I've been kind of down on that idea, and a lot of guys have run out to get one of those treadmills, and I shouldn't talk bad about them. Maybe one day they'll be a sponsor. But I know how you roll for the most part. And given that this book is already kind of out of the hopper, there's got to be about two in queue right now. What else are you writing about?
Yeah, so I've got one that I ghost wrote for James Lawrence, The Iron Cowboy, coming out in March. I'm very excited about that one. He's an amazing guy with an incredible story. And then I'm teeing up one on pacing, the art and science of pacing. Two reasons I'm doing that. One is there's a ton of really interesting research going on in this area now. It's just hot. And so the science is advancing quickly. And the second thing is that people are really bad at pacing.
Right.
Yeah, you know, you're right. You know, I just, you know, my focus as a coach has always been, you know, I train you, I get you in shape, I lead you up to the start line, and then you're on your own. And what I've found over and over is that, you know, people, I'll sort of do that job. You know, people are fit and ready to perform when they get to the start line, but then they blow it with poor pacing. So I've just seen, you know, people really need help with this.
Right.
And I think it really does actually merit, you know, it's a narrow topic, but an important one.
It's a book unto itself, no question.
It is. Yeah.
And that was actually a nice segue into the question I had for you. But before I go there, I want you to know that I've been toying with the idea, and every time I talk to you, I talk about writing another book, and you've already written 75 in the time that I've But I actually am looking at writing a book on lactate tolerance training.
Uh-huh.
And I call it Training the Dark Side, because nice. There's so much that's been written about training aerobically.
Yep.
But the fact of the matter is, understanding how to effectively develop your lactate tolerance and using that energy system to your own end falls very nicely into pacing strategy.
Yep.
And I'm a big fan of time trialing, heart rate specific time trialing, just to start looking at cause and effect. I mean, you look, and I know you're not like hot on just heart rate, but I look at metrics. I look at everything. Go out and run 20 miles, stay aerobic the entire 20 miles. Go out and run 20 miles. And then try to put the hammer down somewhere along the way and see what ends up happening.
Mm-hmm.
And start making decisions about what your pacing strategy is going to look like relative to the outcome of your time trials. So that when you do show up race day, you don't look like a fool because you didn't know where to put the hammer down, what
right.
was going to happen if you did, and so on and so forth. So for whatever it's worth, I think that's going to be a good read. I'm going to be excited to see that.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun one to work on. I think it'll help a lot of athletes.
I was going to ask you about this whole Nike project. The breaking the 2 hours. I'm sure you had some thoughts about that.
Yeah.
Runner's World magazine apparently did an article about this project and the three candidates they have set up to try to break this 2 hour mark and trying to get it done in the very near future. Any thoughts on whether that's your feeling is there's potential or who do you like is potentially the favorite?
Yeah, I don't see it happening anytime soon. I mean, you know, we're 3 minutes away, which is an eternity. You know, if you just rewind, look at how far back you have to go for the last 3 minutes of improvement in, you know, in marathon world record time. So, you know, from 205, you know, high 205s to high 202s. And of course, we're that much closer to whatever, you know, our limit is. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a dismal failure.
So if you had a guess, what do you think the defining factor is going to be that's going to cause us to broach that 2 hours? I mean, looking into variables like weight, strength to weight, force production, aerobic potential, feeding strategy, where do you think there's more room to grow?
I think it has to be a little bit of everything. I don't think it's going to be like, you know, one breakthrough nets us 3 minutes. So if I were involved in this, I would be suggesting, well, you know, one is the surface they run on. There are definitely, you know, better surfaces than asphalt that would make a difference. A small one, I would have the runners be exposed to high energy up-tempo music while they attempted a sub 2 hour marathon, because we know that is performance enhancing. So but you know, is that alone going to make the difference? No. So I think you just have to look at everything that could be exploited that isn't currently being exploited in the marathons where the world records are actually being set, and you know throw them all at it.
Well, the other consideration, too, is that trying to manufacture that time kind of takes some of the fun out of it. You know what I mean? It's like they're talking about drafting strategies and ways that they can, you know, drop 10 seconds per mile if they draft properly. I mean, isn't there somewhere along the way where the cowboy's just got to get up on his pony and get it done? I mean, otherwise, it just doesn't mean that much. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a little torn on that. I actually just got, I subscribed to this newsletter that Mario Fraley does called The Morning Shakeout. It's really good. And he's an ultra purist. So he hates this idea. Yeah. And, you know, he's very persuasive in his rants on it. But there is a part of me that looks at it a different way. I mean, if the whole sport went in this direction, that would be tragic. But as just sort of an addition to it, you know, just sort of a temporary novelty thing, you know, I don't see the harm so much. And it does appeal to sort of another side of me, not the usual fan of competitive running, but, you know, it's just sort of an interesting intellectual puzzle. And so, yeah, I kind of feel two ways about it.
Yeah, so like a windy day at your back with a little bit of a downhill grade, maybe a vehicle in front of you with a big cowl behind it so that you can kind of suck up behind it. Yeah, it just kind of takes some of the fun out of it, I think.
You know? Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that's what they're going to do, but, I mean, they tried everything else. Thank you so much for coming back on. I wish you the very best in this holiday season and be looking forward to seeing the new books as they come out. Tell people how to find your stuff.
Yeah, so start at mattfitzgerald.org, my website. Don't go to .com, that's some other clown.
You know, I bought that website.
You bastard.
No, I didn't.
It had your fingerprints all over it. Should have known.
All right, well, best of luck to you, man, and thanks a lot. I'm gonna reach out to you again when we get this other book out of the hopper.
Fantastic.
All right, buddy, take care. Well, friends, it's time to bring another show to a close. Be sure and tune in to us next week. We've got a lot of great content in store for you. I want you to tell your friends to check us out. You can always find us on Facebook. Simply go search the Natural Running Network. Drop us a message. I'd love to learn more about you and the things you do. And until then, you have an amazing day.